This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, October 4th. I'm John Wanamaker. For 8 years, the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis kept secret thousands of images of pornography seized from one of its priests. An NPR News investigation has found the man remained in ministry. No one called police, even though some of the images seemed to depict minors. After a whistleblower finally called authorities, the police were unable to find images of minors. And there is a warning. This story contains some graphic descriptions. Madeline Barron reports.
Parishioners at St. Jude of the Lake in Matamidi were holding a garage sale in 2004. They were getting rid of a bunch of stuff, including a computer that belonged to Pastor John Shelley. Joe Turnus's father brought it home for his grandkids to play video games. When Turnus opened Shelley's old laptop, he found thousands of images of pornography.
It was graphic, it was hardcore, it was pictures, it was video, just kind of freaked out everybody. I mean, this was something that a bunch of 6-, 7-, 8-year-old kids are going to be using, and this is what was on there waiting for them if somebody hadn't taken the time to go in and look for it. And apart from that, this was the computer from the parish priest where my family went.
Turnus reported his discovery to then Vicar General Kevin McDonough, and he gave the hard drive to the Archdiocese to investigate. Turnus says McDonough met with him and gave him all sorts of assurances.
This was going to be taken care of, that John Shelley was going to get appropriate counseling, or however it was that they put it at the time. And the thing that we all wanted to make sure was that this wasn't going to be treated like all of the things that we'd seen in the news to that point with the Catholic Church, where people just get picked up and moved around and, you know, things get swept under the rug.
This was 2004, 2 years after the clergy sex abuse scandal rocked the Roman Catholic Church. Dioceses around the country were putting child safety plans in place. Turnus says he doesn't know if the images on the computer were child pornography, but he was quite sure Shelley didn't belong in a parish. A forensic computer investigator hired by the Archdiocese cataloged and reported 2,300 adult sites and images on Shelley's laptop. He concluded the hard drive had been used exclusively by Shelley, and while many of the pornographic images were of adults, some were referred to as borderline illegal because of the youthful-looking male images. The investigator found the priest's search terms included free naked boy pics. Shelley had two other computers at the time that the Archdiocese never got to see. Former canon lawyer Jennifer Hasselberger says Chancery files explain what Shelley did.
He immediately destroyed one of them.
How did he destroy it?
He hit it with a hammer, like the hard drive. He attacked that hard drive with a hammer. That's what sticks in my mind.
Hasselberger says Shelley gave a third computer to his attorney, and the Archdiocese never recovered it. Later that year, the Archbishop sent Father Shelley to St. Luke Institute in Maryland for evaluation. Shelley was later assigned to ministry at St. John the Baptist in Jordan. The CDs of images taken from Shelley's laptop sat at the chancery of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis for 4 more years. In 2008, they were moved to the basement. Hasselberger says the discs were stored with a warning.
There was a handwritten note attached to those CD-ROMs in Father McDonough's handwriting saying something to the effect of, you know, don't insert these discs into a computer that's attached to the internet and see previous report prior to viewing images.
In 2011, Shelley was up for a promotion and Hasselberger started looking more closely at his file. Hasselberger was in charge of the Archdiocese records, and she advised the Archbishop on church law. She realized the church was entering a new era of consequences. That year, the Bishop of Kansas City was convicted of a criminal charge for failing to call police when he learned of child pornography on a priest's computer. In the Shelley file, Hasselberger says she found some troubling details to share with then-Vicar General Peter Laird. They included a complaint from a summer camp counselor in the mid-90s about how Shelley, as a seminarian, wrestled with young boys and spent time in the cabins after lights out, and a report that an 18-year-old parishioner was living in the rectory with Shelley in 2009. Hasselberger decided to view the discs herself.
I came across images that, I don't think there's any question at this point, were minors.
Sexual images of?
Yes, of boys. I placed them aged 12 to 14, and then other images in the 16 to 18 range, but definitely a number of images that were below 16.
Hasselberger was furious. She went on a stampede through the chancery. She confronted a church official, holding open her laptop.
Would you look at this? You know, you want to tell me this was borderline illegal? And I remember him just shaking his head and me saying, how did we not report this to police? How did we not report this to police?
She says a deacon who'd formerly worked for the St. Paul Police Sex Crimes Unit told her the laws on reporting child pornography are complicated. But the response of one church official stunned her the most.
Because what he said is that I could be charged for possession of child pornography because the images were in my office and I was aware that they were child pornography.
Not getting anywhere with her colleagues, Hasselberger decided to go for what she considered the nuclear option.
I copied the images that I had found that were so troubling to me. I pasted them into a Word document. I wrote a memo to the Archbishop, and I attached the images to the memo saying, this is what we're dealing with.
The photos showed boys performing oral sex. She warned Archbishop Neinstedt that the images had not been reported to authorities, which raised the question of potential charges against the archdiocese. Then Hasselberger says then Vicar General Peter Laird informed her she was off the case and to hand over the Shelley files.
I did as I was told. I put it all in the banker's box. I turned it over. I went back to my office. I closed the door and I called Ramsey County.
But when St. Paul police got the discs 2 weeks later, an investigator called Hasselberger asking her to describe the images she'd seen because none of the images handed over by the archdiocese depicted minors. Hasselberger resigned in April because she didn't approve of what was going on, and the Shelley case and others showed her she couldn't change anything. On Wednesday, St. Paul police quietly closed the Shelley investigation without charges. They cited insufficient evidence. In a police report, the lead investigator wrote, quote, whether discs given to me were the actual discs or copies of those discs after first asking for them, I do not know, nor will I most likely ever know, end quote. At a related hearing this week, a lawyer for the Archdiocese called Hasselberger unsophisticated and imprudent for her handling of the Shelley case. The attorney said no one at the church found anything illegal. John Shelley is currently on sabbatical and living in Minneapolis. An NPR News reporter approached him at his house yesterday.
There's no criminal stuff involved in it or whatever, and it was 10 years ago. If you're going to take my name and drag it through the mud now, 10 years later, for something that you clearly don't have all the facts on, that's something you're free to do, but I'm not going to add to it.
Shelley says he expects to be back in ministry. The Archdiocese did not respond to interview requests late yesterday amid growing concern about the church's handling of child sexual abuse allegations. Vicar General Peter Laird resigned. Madeline Barron, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Meanwhile, the recent departures of two gay staff members at Totino Grace High School in Fridley have sparked a number of conversations about Catholic school policy, Catholic teachings, and how the church views homosexuality. But here's something that further complicates the topic. Catholic schools are not consistent in how they deal with faculty and staff who are in same-sex relationships. Tim Post reports.
Bill Hudson, the president of Totino Grace, resigned this summer after announcing he was in a nearly two-decade-long committed same-sex relationship. That got Totino Grace families talking. Then late in the summer, longtime English teacher Kristen Ostendorf was fired after she told colleagues she was gay, in a relationship with a woman, and happy. The conversations kicked up again.
Within minutes, my phone was ringing.
Amy Holton has a son who is a sophomore at the Catholic high school.
You know, people wanted to talk. Most people were shocked and saddened and needed to talk.
Holton from Maple Grove says discussion among her family and friends followed a similar theme. They were sad to see Ostendorf and Hudson go, but felt it was a necessary move. The Archdiocese of Minneapolis and St. Paul owns and governs Totino Grace. The school follows the Archdiocesan employment policy. It maintains employees can be fired over public conduct that is inconsistent with Catholic teachings. The church does not recognize same-sex marriage and teaches that homosexual acts are sinful. Holton, who's Catholic, says Totino Grace is a welcoming place that embraces students from all backgrounds. But she says allowing school employees to be in same-sex relationships is not compatible with her views on Catholic education.
I expect my children to be formed in the Catholic Church. That's what we chose. You know, we want to see that the school's promoting that, and we want good role models. Anything less than that would not be acceptable.
Another mom with two sons at Totino Grace is Robin Sitars. She agrees with that by-the-book approach, at least for now. But Sitars says she and many of the families she's talked to hope for a change in church policy that allows gay employees at schools to be open about their relationships.
They're hoping to see that change and that there is a more loving, open-arm environment.
Sitars isn't Catholic, but her husband and children are. She's encouraged by recent comments from Pope Francis, who said the Catholic Church has focused too much on some social issues, including homosexuality.
He appears to wanting to be focused on helping others and taking care of others rather than focusing on the rules of the church.
The Pope's comments come as more states, like Minnesota, have legalized gay marriage. How Catholic schools deal with openly gay employees is primarily a function of who oversees the school, a diocese or a religious order, who owns the school, and how conservative their leadership is. There's no consistent policy for how Catholic schools and colleges treat openly gay teachers or staff who are in relationships.
At the reception. So that actually, by the cake, there's a whole lot of space there.
Here's something you might not expect to see at a Catholic college. Recently, Steve Humrickhouse and his then-fiancée, Terry Sullivan, made last-minute wedding plans with their photographer. They were in the cafeteria at the University of St. Thomas's downtown Minneapolis campus. Since then, the two men have gotten married. Humrickhouse directs the college's Office on Workplace Diversity. St. Thomas is a private Catholic liberal arts university that's not owned or governed by the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis. Humrickhouse has heard some tension among gay employees who are hesitant to come out to their colleagues, but says he's never faced discrimination at the college.
People know it. It's not a surprise. My partner's photograph and us, we're on my desk here, both of us, and that's never been an issue.
Humrickhouse hopes to hear more talk at Catholic schools about how to accept gay employees who are in relationships. He heard some of that dialogue recently from St. Thomas's new president. During her convocation speech, she said the college should strive to be more welcoming, regardless of someone's sexuality or the gender of their spouse. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And the sources in this story came from Minnesota Public Radio's Public Insight Network. If you want to share your insight, go to nprnews.org/insight. The state of Minnesota and the Minnesota Vikings officially are partners in a new billion-dollar real estate deal. The team and the state's stadium authority signed a pair of binding agreements last night. Now comes the hard part, paying the mortgage. Reporter Tim Nelson has more.
After a decade of negotiations that included threats and promises, the Vikings showed Minnesota the money last night. The team stacked up a subsidy from the NFL, a personal seed license plan, and future naming rights to pay its $477 million share of the new stadium. Then the Vikings owners kicked in another nine figures to seal the deal.
The $100 million in equity is cash coming from the wealth, from the pockets of our owners.
That's Vikings Chief Financial Officer Steve Poppin. The financing details were made public as the team and the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority signed a pair of agreements more than 500 pages long. As Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton had demanded, the team committed more of its own cash to the project in the end. That's money on top of the other revenues the Vikings earmarked to pay their 49% share of the billion-dollar stadium project. But Vikings fans will have to put up, too. The state has agreed to sell $125 million in personal seed licenses on the team's behalf. The licenses will range in price from $10,000 to $500, although the average seed license will cost about $2,500 each. And three out of four fans will have to buy a license in the 65,000-seat stadium. The licenses are one-time fees that give buyers ownership of a seat. They're also commodities that can be traded or sold. Governor Mark Dayton conceded as the deal was signed that it wasn't all he was hoping for when he started talks with the team more than 2 years ago.
I can safely assume that for most Minnesotans, this will look like a questionable deal because the economics of professional sports are highly questionable all over this country.
But Dayton said a $500 million in taxpayer money and tens of millions more from fans were ultimately worth it.
We've been dealing with this from the very beginning that if we want to keep a team in Minnesota, if we want all the jobs that the project's going to provide, we want to have this as a magnet for further economic development in that blighted part of Minneapolis, that we had to make a deal, and we had to get the owners of the team to agree to a deal.
Vikings fans are of several minds about the plan. Lonnie Van Cly of Stillwater has had his seats in the Metrodome for 20 years, and like many, he concedes he'll pay.
It's not a deal breaker. I guess I'd bite the bullet. So it's kind of like paying taxes, I guess. It's not that you want to do it, but you have to do it. And I've just been part of the experience for too many years to just let it go away and sit at home and watch it.
But others balk at the very idea of paying twice, because even if you buy a sea license for hundreds of dollars, you still need to buy tickets. Dixie and Jim Hilton of Hastings don't like it, and said so as the Vikings played Cleveland last month.
It's the principle mainly, but it's a little bit of the money as well.
Because we're about ready to retire, and we don't need, you know, we spend like $1,500 a year anyway. So we would have to spend another $3,000 just for the privilege of sitting in these seats.
But it may be months before they and other fans actually know what it'll take to keep their seats. The Vikings have rented space for a sales center in Minneapolis and will be rolling out prices and payment plans by early next year. The team itself will be signing off on nearly $400 million in loans to come up with construction cash. Stadium Authority Chairwoman Michelle Kelm-Helgen says the state will borrow $498 million, an amount that includes the city of Minneapolis's share. After the financing closes in mid-November, the construction preparations will begin and the Metrodome will soon be history.
The team will finish their season sometime in January, hopefully after a playoff game or two. And we would have the building be taken down beginning then in February.
The new stadium is scheduled to open in July of 2016. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. The leader of a Minneapolis-based group serving Somali-American youth was on Capitol Hill yesterday, testifying before a congressional committee investigating the Somali terror group Al-Shabaab. The House Foreign Affairs Committee called the hearing on Al-Shabaab because of the group's ability to recruit young fighters from the United States. Mohamed Farah is executive director of the group Kajog. He says defeating Al-Shabaab and its radical message will be an uphill battle, especially when nonprofits like his lack the necessary resources.
I urge this committee and our federal government, my government, to stand with us to fight Al-Shabaab and eliminate this cancerous ideology.
Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for a four-day attack on a Nairobi shopping mall last month. The FBI says they have yet to confirm the identities of the attackers. A Minnesota homeowner could get hit with about a 20% premium increase just for filing one claim. Martin Moylan has details.
In a nationwide review, InsuranceQuotes.com looked at the impact of a single claim of up to $30,000 for a home insured for $144,000. Minnesota had the highest average rate increase, 21%. InsuranceQuotes says homeowners should consider if they're better off not filing smaller claims. Regardless, premiums have been soaring for all Minnesota homeowners in recent years, whether or not they've made claims. Mark Kulda is a spokesman for the Insurance Federation of Minnesota.
Since 1998, we've had an enormous number of catastrophes, and now we're a top catastrophe state, and we no longer have a good bargain on homeowners insurance.
Rates for the average Minnesota homeowner insurance policy rose more than 250% from 1997 to 2010, reaching almost $1,000 a year. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Locked-out Minnesota orchestra musicians say they are deeply honored but also heartbroken that recently resigned music director Osmo Fenske will conduct them in three concerts this weekend. The events at Ted Mann Hall at the University of Minnesota are being described as an opportunity for Fenske to say thank you and farewell to the community. Principal trombone player Doug Wright predicted it will be an emotional but apolitical night.
It's not about contract disputes. It's not about money. It's not about any of those things that have been reported ad nauseum over the past year and a half. This is going to be about music, the power of music, and us coming together one last time while we join him as he says farewell.
In a statement, Minnesota Orchestra President and CEO Michael Hansen said audiences deserve the concerts. The concerts tonight and Saturday evening are sold out. Musicians added an extra show Saturday afternoon. Duluth is touting employment gains in its growing aviation sector. An aircraft maintenance company called AAR has created 276 jobs in the past year and plans to hire 40 more workers. The region's aviation sector, which includes plane manufacturers Cirrus and Kestrel, is expected to grow by 40% in the next 7 years. Duluth Mayor Don Ness says the new jobs are creating new challenges.
Now it's up to our community to deliver on our end of the bargain, which is to make sure that we continue to deliver on the talent, make sure that we're continuing to deliver on the quality, affordable housing in our community so that the folks that get a job here at AAR have a place to live.
The city's rental vacancy rate is currently less than 1%. Employment in the region is expected to grow by 13% in the next 7 years. And that's the NPR News Update for Friday, October 4th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.